Welcome back. Good moed, good vach. Just a few special announcements. First of all, I want to thank Ronnie and Shirley Baruch who are sponsoring today's shiur. Unfortunately, for the loss of Ronnie's brother-in-law from Oceanside, Yosef Eliyahu ben Yaakov Lev, who was niftar a week and a half ago. From the virus, and Be'ezras Hashem, it should be Aliyas Neshama for him and continued Chizuk for the Mishpacha always. I'd like to also take a moment to wish a Mazel Tov to Moish and Liora Berger on the birth of a grandson on the first day of Yom Tov. And we're going to be learning and celebrating that in the Shir today. Be'ezras Hashem, he should enter Bevrisoi Shel Avraham Avinu Be'itoi Ovizmano. And on that note, actually, thank you for sharing as well. I just got the message from Jonathan Niederman as well that we have another baby boy on the first day of Yom Tov as well. So Baruch Hashem, lots of wonderful, wonderful smachos. It's wonderful to share. It's nice to come back with good news. So thank you for sharing. And Mitzvah Hashem, we should have many, many, many more good news to share, Be'ezras Hashem. I'm going to put everybody on mute just for this moment now, and we're going to continue Mitzvah Shana learning, and I'm going to open up at the end. So here we go. So what we are going to do is we're going to be following through a very, very fascinating strand of Machshav. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to come today. I know, listen, it's Chol HaMoed. We want to take a late start to the day. It's Chol HaMoed after all. But let's start at the very beginning, and let's try to get some sort of perspective into what's going on. I had the opportunity over Yom Tov of learning some of the works of Rav Moshe Shapira. There's an incredible institute which is putting out his works, and they are named Shuvi VeNechazeh, which is fascinating. There is I went through a beautiful, beautiful idea which I would like to share and perhaps learn together in the next few minutes. Here's how it goes. So what we're going to do is we're going to start at the very beginning. You know, the Rambam talks about this idea that there's these principles of faith. You have to believe in certain things if you are going to be called a Jew. And if you don't believe in them, you're kind of out of the fold. So the question that everybody asks the Rambam is where did you get that from? Where in the world did you invent that you have to believe certain things? The Torah tells us we certainly have to do certain things. The Torah tells us that, in fact, there are certain things we have to love Hashem. There's emotions which are mandated. There's actions which are mandated. There are speech. There's words which are mandated. But since when in the world is it that we have to be believing certain things? When did that come into the equation? So the Rambam says this very explicitly in the beginning of the last parak of Sanhedrin, where he says that based on the Mishnah that Kol Yisrael Yeshalem Chelek LaOlam Haba, and the Mishnah gives three exceptions: a Kofar Bikoros and a person who denies Tchiyas HaMeisim. The Rambam then goes on to say, "I have 13 principles of faith, and these are them." And he explains each one of them or each of those 13 principles. And there's been much debate over history. We actually spent three summers learning through the Ikarim one by one, and with three introductions. So we spent a little bit of time looking at these Ikarim, looking at these principles of faith. The question that everybody asks the Rambam is, "Where did you get them from?" So one of the interesting things is like this, is let's pretend right now that we do not know about this Rambam. We didn't know about the Ani Mamins at the end of Davening, which are based on the Rambams. We didn't know about Yigdal at the end of Friday Night Davening, which is also based on the 13 principles of faith. Let's pretend we didn't know anything of that. So let's look at the Torah and open up the book, so to speak, and say to ourselves a very basic question. Does the Torah ask us to believe anything? Are there foundational elements of our faith that the Torah does ask us to believe in? And if we're to look with that, we'll call it intellectually honest prism. Would we be able to find anything in the Torah which is necessary to believe in order to be Jewish? Good question, right? Meaning, would there be something that were you lacking it, everything else would fall apart? So it's not so simple. You see, that's the difference between what we'll call a belief, an axiom, so to speak, and a commandment, a mandate. A mandate is that, yes, you have to do X, you have to do Y, you have to do Z, you have to do these actions. And if you don't do, failing such, well, you miss out something. Perhaps it could be greatly egregious or less egregious, depending on the punishment the Torah tells us. But that's an action. How do we know that there's a notion called an axiom of faith, something which, so to speak, is the structure of the system, failing which, if a person were not to have, would lose the faith itself? Does the Torah ever reference anything that is of such magnitude? And the truth is that not necessarily a certain principle, but the Torah does mention there's one thing which does seem to be very central to everything we do, and that is Exodus. Yetzias Mitzrayim. How do we know? Because wherever we go, we see Exodus, we see Yetzias Mitzrayim. So as an example, Shabbos in the second set of Dibros in Parshas Vayeschanan is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim. We know Shabbos is one of the mitzvahs which is connected to our Torah Kula. It has great gravity. In fact, today we use the expression if it's a person Shomer Shabbos or not Shomer Shabbos. That is part of the equation because Shabbos is so important. Why is it? Because Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. All the Mo'adim, all the festivals, Pesach, of course, but all the rest of the Yomim Tovim are also Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, even Sukkos and even Shavuos. Tzitzis, which is Keneged Kol HaTorah, Keneged Kol HaMitzvos, L'man Tizkru, V'Azimus Kol Mitzvos Yisai, is a remembrance of Pesach. Tfilin, the two times it's mentioned in the end of Parshas Bo, is Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. Kedushas Bechor, the sanctity of the firstborn, of course. Ribis, the prohibition of Rama'us and trickery when it comes to scales and measures. The prohibition of Oinah, of cheating. All these things are Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. So, and we'll call it, if you were to say, which is a particular commandment, which is a particular notion, which really underlies a lot of Torah thought or Torah ideas, one would easily say that the idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of leaving Egypt, which is why just two nights ago at the Seder, when we encountered one of those children who was less than exuberant about the Seder, who was less than excited about what everything that was going on, and he says to us, "Ma ha'avoido hazois lachem," this fellow who we call the Ben Harosha says, "What's all this business for you?" We say to him, "Kevon shekofar be'ikar," because he denied ikar, which means the main thing, the idea, because he denied that, therefore, if he were to be there, he would not be redeemed. Wow, that's a big statement. Right over there you have that if I don't believe, if I disagree with the notion of Exodus, then somehow I've left it. I've stepped over that red line. I'm not in the party anymore. That's what seems to be pretty clear from this. Why is that so central? So this goes back to a very beautiful thought, which we have studied a number of times together, but that is a very, very beautiful and famous Ramban, Nachmanides, is found at the end of Parshas Bo. And he says, look, he asks exactly this question. Why is it that the Torah makes so many commandments dependent on Exodus? Why is that necessary? Meaning to say, let's say, you know, trickery or price gouging, or no. That should be an objective principle. Why do I need to make it based on Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim? Why is it that when I kiss my mezuzah and then when I'm thinking about my tefillin, my tzitzis, why is that all, am I bringing back, conjuring up this national consciousness of Exodus? Why is that so important? So the Ramban explains that because underlying Yetzias Mitzrayim were three principles, were three very important principles of faith, failing which, if we do not have them, then somehow we would be missing some of the most important elements of our religion, of our belief system. He points out, the Ramban explains that if you remember as at the Seder when we talked about Rabbi Yehuda, who says, Hayonosim Bayim Simonim, another three drops of wine come out, Detzach Adash Ba'achav, when he groups them together into 3, 3, 4 in the Makos, he points out that each of those separate sections have a different underlying point. One is, as he says very, very explicitly, he says, L'man Teda, I'm going to just go quote the Ramban himself, yeah? He says, the first one is that you should know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Borei, is the creator of the world. That is Keneged, the Kofrim, Keneged, the people who deny Hashem and says that there was no God. And Umeim HaKishim Yudosah Pratis, V'omru Iko Yeda V'yesh Deya Be'elyon, They say that, you know what, maybe there is a God, but he doesn't really know or care about what's going on in the world. Maybe Hashem knows about what's going on in the world, but doesn't really care enough to get involved in the details. There are three different types of, we'll call it denial of God. Denial of the existence of God. Denial of that we accept that God exists, but he doesn't really know. Or he knows, but he doesn't really care to get involved. Those are three levels of denial that people have about God. So therefore, he says, if you look through the Makos and Tetzach Adash Ba'achav, you will notice the phrases which appear are exactly to correspond to those fallacies in belief. One is Leman Teida Ki Ani Hashem Bekerav Aretz, that Hashem says you should not, Hashem, I'm in the earth to express Hashkacha, that Hashem is involved, that he did not leave it. Leman Teida Ki La Hashem Ha'aretz, to say that Hashem it didn't just leave the world behind and create it. And finally, Leman Teida Ki La Hashem Ha'aretz, that is able to control this world. So Ramban points out that each of those different stages of the Makos was to correspond to each of those fallacies and belief. That Hashem created the world, that Hashem is still involved in the world, that Hashem is involved, that not only sees, but actually is involved in the specific details of the world on a day-to-day basis. So therefore, the Makos, he believes, is the training academy for us to be able to learn those messages necessary of these basic beliefs in God. That Hashem exists, that Hashem sees, and that Hashem is involved in every day-to-day aspect of our lives. And the Ramban goes on to say, that's why that we remember Yetzias Mitzrayim in almost everything we do on a daily basis. Because these are such central beliefs to our system that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to one day say, you know, well, if you want a demonstration, I'll put on this little sideshow for you during the course of history. Hashem says, no, I did it all then. I proved to you incandescently clear this is how it is and this is what it's meant to be. And now you're going to remember back to that throughout all of history to know that I proved it already. That's the whole point of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So if we think about that in that perspective, why is Yetzias Mitzrayim so important? Why is Exodus so important? Because it reminds us of many of the basic beliefs incorporated into the process of Exodus itself. So you ask yourself, well, Rambam, Maimonides, where did you get these 13 principles of faith? Well, one very basic way of looking at it is if you look at Exodus, if you look at Yetzias Mitzrayim itself, you can see embedded into it many of the core beliefs. Yes, and the Torah says very explicitly that we need to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim. Failing such would be kofer ba'ikar, would be denying everything. So that's perhaps one way we could tease it out. Now that helps with a lot of things. That really helps with the existence of God, the Hashgacha Pratis of God, prayer even, all these aspects of the 13 axioms of faith. And it even helps us with, let's say, prophecy, because there's the prophecy of Moshe, and later on there's going to be that they're going to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the revelation of Sinai, which is sort of the end process of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We get all of that. There's one principle of faith which doesn't seem to naturally fall into this area, and that is the principle called Tchias HaMeisim, resurrection of the dead. This is a very, 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 very powerful idea. And so here we are. For those who are looking for that Ramban, I do not make source sheets for today, but the Ramban is found in Shmois Perik Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tez Zayin. It's a very long Ramban, it's a very, very beautiful Ramban, there's much more to say about it. But let's start at the beginning over here. It's true that if we look at Exodus per se, we can look at and uncover in it many of the axioms of faith as the Ramban explains to us, which is why perhaps the Torah is focusing on this. But the idea of Tchias HaMeisim, which is the 13th and ultimate of all of the principles of faith, does not seem to be necessarily something which is naturally emerging from the Exodus, if that's going to be the format of finding out where our principles of faith emerge from. So where does that come from then? Where, if we're going to assume that Yetzias Mitzrayim is the core, the fundamental, we'll call it foundation of faith, then why is it that there is this notion of resurrection of the dead? Where does that come from? Why is that necessarily an outcome of Yetzias Mitzrayim? That's the basic question. That's perhaps what we're going to try to deal with in the next little bit. Why is resurrection of the dead so necessary to be able to understand this? And of course, we should not be missing the moment of course, the Haftorah and Shavuos Chol HaMoed Pesach, which we just missed yesterday, for those of Baalei Kriya, which was in fact the exact description of resurrection of the dead. So why is resurrection of the dead so important? Why is it part of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but we can't really see it as part of the natural belief system of Yetzias Mitzrayim? So that's our journey. That's our mission. So when we understand this principle, before the Rambam even came along, the denying Tchias HaMesim, denying resurrection of the dead, is already a red line. The Mishnah is pretty clear about this. In the beginning of the 11th or 10th parak of Sanhedrin, whether you're looking at the Mishnayos or the Gemara, in Mishnayos it's it is the second last parak, it's the 10th parak. And in the Gemara it is the last parak of Mishnayos, it's called parak Chelek. Famously, the Mishnah tells us that Kol Yisrael Yeshalem Chelek Lo Lamabon. That's why the reason the parak is called such. All of Israel have a portion in the world to come. So that's the good news, right? But that's not the only news. So there's also the bad news. The bad news is the end of the Mishnah, which says that So yes, it is true. By default, we're all in, but there are those who are not in. And here they are. There's three of them, the Mishnah tells us. Omer. The person who says there is no resurrection of the dead from the Bible, from the Torah, that Torah is not from heaven, and a person who denies Hashem, these are the three things which would discredit a person from the world to come. These are basically, by the way, as the Sefer HaYikarim of Yosef Albo explains, these are the principles of the three foundations of faith, which is God, Torah Min HaShemayim, and reward and punishment. And that's the format. All the Rambam's 13 can be collapsed into these three, which is why the Rambam's 13 principles of faith are expounded upon in this Mishnah. Interestingly enough, there's a lot to be talked about in this in and of itself. Nonetheless, so it is interesting that when describing Tchias HaMesem, when describing not believing in Tchias HaMesem, the Mishnah describes the person who says, Ein Tchias HaMesem min HaTorah, a person who denies whether Tchias HaMesem is from the Torah. Now, technically speaking, the way it should be phrased as a person who does not believe in Tchias HaMesem at all. Meaning, if you don't believe in resurrection of the dead, you're out. But it says, Ha'omer en Tchias HaMesem min HaTorah. You don't believe Tchias HaMesem is from the Torah. Which leads Rashi to say that maybe you could even conceptually believe in Tchias HaMesem, but you don't believe it as part of the Drashos Chazal. You don't believe it's part of the theology of our tradition. Then you're out. That's it. Too bad. So what's going on here exactly? What does this mean? What is the mission trying to hint at? Why is resurrection of the dead necessary to believe as part of the system? So the Gemara describes a very interesting interaction in a few on Daf Tzadi Aleph Amud Aleph between an individual by the name of Gvia ben Pesisa and a min. A min is a person who is a apikoros, a person who is a heretic, and he's challenging Gvia ben Pesisa about this particular issue. So here's the conversation. It's a little bit of an enigmatic conversation. We're going to have to prize open it a little bit in just a moment. So the min says to Gvia ben Pesisa, "Vaylochon chayava, chayavaya damrisun meisi chayin de chayin meisi de meisi chayin." So here's how it works. He says, "Look," he says, "You wicked people, meaning you Jewish people, believe in this. You say the dead will come to life." But the way of the world is that those who are alive, who are dead. So how can you say that the dead will come to life? Meaning, if I look around me at the rest of the world, generally speaking, I've noticed a trend, and that is live people die and dead people don't live. So what kind of notion is this that you say that there is this resurrection of dead? So Gavir Ben Bessisa responds to him and says, his response is the following. He's Amale, Vailachon Chayavaya Damrison Mesi Loi Chayin, Deloi Havi Chayi, Da Havi Chayi Loi Koshikain. So the response that Gvia ben Pesisa has, of course, very enigmatic, he says, "Woe to you who are wicked. You say the dead won't come to life." He says, "But those who are not yet in existence come to life." What's he referring to? Those who are not yet born come to life. Is it not reasonable to assume, therefore, definitely, that those who are alive and die will certainly come to life? That's the way that Gvia ben Pesisa responds. By the way, it's important to notice the time period of Gvia ben Pesisa, who's in this response. He's at the end of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. He's around the time at the beginning of where Pirkei Avos picks up Shimon HaTzadik and at Antigonos Ish Soichai. And it was the two students of Antigonos Ish Soichai, Baitos and Sadok, who were the ones who, so to speak, you know, broke away into sectarian groups who believed only in the Torah Shebichsav, only in the written law, not the oral law. So it's important just to put that into perspective when Gevir is living. And this is significant because what really essentially he's saying is that this fellow is saying is, look, I take things at face value. I take things as the way I see it exists. And I look outside and I don't see anybody, you know, just jumping out of their graves necessarily. So all I see is people jumping into graves more than the other way around. So therefore, it doesn't make sense that this principle which you sages created really exists. And Gavir Sisa says, no, actually, fundamentally, if you see something in the world, in the natural course of the cycle of the world, where you see something where you take two cells which are insignificant microscopically, suddenly put the two together, and remarkably, 9 months later, there's an emergence of a human being. That means to say you can take two insignificant pieces of biological material, then surely when you have a more sophisticated biological material, and you put that into the ground in the incubation period over there, would you not expect that at some point in time, perhaps the incubation period will be longer, but there will be the emergence of future life, which is even more sophisticated. The way the Gemara goes on to describe that, on the next daf on Tzadi Beis Amun Aleph, is it says that based on the pasuk in Mishlei, which we actually covered recently, is that it says that it describes Sha'ol v'Oitzer Rechem. It talks about two concepts which it puts together. One is the netherworld and one is the womb. And the Gemara says that why is the netherworld, that means after death, and the idea of the womb put together, those seem to be very disparate ideas. One's the beginning of life, one's the end of life. So the Gemara responds and says, no, because ma rechem machnis umoitzi af she'ol machnis umoitzi. That in the same way as the rechem absorbs the cell, the sperm cell, and brings out full life, so too the netherworld takes in a body and projects out a even more sophisticated life form when the resurrection of the dead happens. And the Gemara goes on to say that in fact it's a build-up, because the point of conception of the human being is b'chashai, is done in a very quiet environment. Nobody really notices any differences for the first little bit. But and when the baby is born, it's b'kolos. That doesn't just mean to say the screaming. That also means to say that it's a moment of celebration and publicity. But then at the end, so certainly if a person who dies, which is b'kolos, which is a public event, then certainly the resurrection of the dead will be even more of a glamorous event of the return of life. That's what the Gemara says. What do you see is at stake in this Gemara? The Gemara seems to be saying, what Gavir ben Persis seems to be arguing, is that you have to understand that the idea of resurrection of the dead itself is a naturally inborn into the system. It means to say, this is not something which is supernatural. This is not something which is unusual. This is something which perhaps don't see so frequently. Right, there are certainly many times which has occurred in history. But this is something which that is built into the system in the same way we see the initial parts of the system already in operation in nature. To say that maybe it does exist, but it's supernatural, it's outside the system, it isn't necessarily, we'll call it, necessary as part of the system. That is perhaps even part of what the Mishnah is saying is a kofer, a person who denies because they don't believe that it is necessary as well. If you think about this, I remember that Rav Dessler writes in Michta Meliyahu a beautiful insight. He says, you know, imagine that one day, you know, you're going past a graveyard, and as you're driving past the cemetery, you notice that a hand is emerging from the earth. You know, you would collapse. You'd stop your car. You'd go take pictures within 5 minutes. All the news agencies would be there. It would be viral on social media, and slowly, you know, hands emerge and people start pulling themselves out. You're like, well, you know, you don't do the same thing when you're looking in your backyard and suddenly you see a stem emerging from the back of your backyard. But if you think about it, there's not so much difference. You take a seed, and you put the seed into the earth. And over the next few days, in the moisture and in the earth together, it starts rotting. And if you actually dig it out at that point in time, it would look completely rotten and disintegrated. And then, a few days later, remarkably speaking, out comes new life. Now, we're just like, yeah, of course, call the landscape and let's trim the bushes, right? But in the end of the day, what makes that more natural than the other process? The reason is because we don't see the other process so often, right? We're kind of building up towards that. But why should the one exist and the other shouldn't exist? The answer is because we see that one more frequently. So what the Gemara seems to be saying over here is resurrection of the dead is a naturally inborn process into the world. It just happens to be that we're waiting for the finish line to get to that point where we're able to see this. Now, Now, let's put that concept on hold. The idea that that it is necessary somehow, Tchiyas HaMeisim, resurrection, that it is a necessary component of the creation. Now let's try to understand how Yetzias Mitzrayim could be connected to this. So here's the starting point. Fascinating point. The Torah begins Bereishis in the beginning. We all know how the Torah begins. In fact, Rashi says a very interesting thing. Rashi says at the beginning of the Torah, he quotes Rabbi Yitzchak. Some people debate whether this is Rashi's father or not. Be it as it may, he quotes Rabbi Yitzchak who says, you know, strictly speaking, the Torah could have started at a different point. Wait a second. Isn't always the best place to start at the beginning? That's how the song goes. Why is there that we're starting? Why would you think otherwise? So Rashi says, no. We could have started at HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. Shmoyis Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Beis, where it says, this month is to you Rosh Chodashim, the first communal mitzvah ever given to Israel. Now, that's like a little bit of a strange Rashi, because the assumption of Rashi, it seems like, is that, you know, let's cut out all the stories, right? Let's get tachlis, mitzvahs, right? Let's get down to commandments. But that assumption is faulty. Meaning, look at the rest of the Torah for a second. You know, there's large stretches of the Torah, say, for instance, in Devarim as an example, in Bamidbar, which are all narrative, right? They're not commandments. And nobody ever asks and says, you know what, why don't we just, you know, edit out this paragraph? Why don't we just, you know, make this parasha a little quicker? Nobody says that. So what is even the basis of the question that Rashi's asking at the very beginning, saying, no, we could have started later on. We'll skip all the fluffy stuff, we'll skip the narrative, and let's get down to tachlis, what we're supposed to be doing in the world. Nobody ever makes that assumption elsewhere in the Torah. Why would Rashi suddenly ask this question in the beginning? And HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, meaning out of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, you know, why is that the one that has to start it? Why couldn't it be any other mitzvah? Why is it so significant? What's the connection between Bereishis Perek Aleph and then HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, Shmoyis Perek Yud Beis, which is so significant in order to understand this? That's the basic question that Rav Moshe Shapiro asked, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this for just a moment to understand this. And it goes back to the conception of time, how you look at time. So you see, there's two ways of looking at time. There's actually multiple ways of looking at time, but the most basic way of looking at time is time is a container. It's a framework. Like space is a framework. So in physical space exists, you know, everything else in the world. So too, in time is a container into which everything else fits. So therefore, in order for the world to exist, you need to have two frameworks of this container. One is time and one is space. And then between the two of those, everything else exists. You know, if you think about this for a moment, When you cry, this always fascinates me. When a person crosses the road safely, and every should always crosses the road safely, but as you cross the road safely, the reason why it's safe is because you're distinct either in time or place from any other vehicle which is moving there. So one way of doing it is that, you know, like, even though I'm in the middle of the road right now, and cars cross the middle of the road all the time, it's at this point in time what separates me from other things, other vehicles, other moving objectives. Objects is the fact that in time, right, it's now a green light for me, so I'm able to cross. So at this point in time, it separates me from everything else. The other way is space. It could be it's also a red light, but in space there's nothing coming, so I'm able to go. So either in time or space, I'm separated from other things. That's the framework of existence. But if that's our way of looking at time, then there's nothing specific or unique. It isn't moving towards anywhere. It isn't coming from somewhere. It just is. It's just sort of the framework. When you look at the word for time in Judaism, what's the word for time? There's numerous words that we have for it, but one of the words we use is zman, which is not exactly the translation of time. Time is a very neutral kind of word. The word zman actually means hazmana, which means to prepare or to dedicate. The Gemara has a debate of hazmana milsahi. If I set aside something to be something which has a holy purpose, then can I use it for other things? That's what's called hazmana. The word zman actually is, as Lashon HaKodesh usually demonstrates, is connected to the idea of a destination, or the idea of something being specific and having a point and a tafkid in this world. Similarly, another word for time is mo'ed, right? And in fact, the time that we're given at HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, when we're given the so to speak, the magic wand of being able to dictate time to a certain degree, is being able to impact and affect the mo'adim. The mo'adim are the festivals. All the festivals are going to be impacted by ability to create the calendar. The mo'ed, again, is also a specific time, a destination, a moed is a time of gathering. It's a fixed moment in the calendar. What ultimately is being, so to speak, argued over, if you think about this for a moment, is what is our framework of time? How do we look at time as a whole? Because you see, when we go back to Bereshis in the first place, let's just remember something very basic. The Mishnah in Avos tells us that the world was created in 10 ma'amoros, in 10 utterances. And the reason the Mishnah gets that is very simple, is that if you open up Genesis Perek Aleph, you open up the first chapter of Bereshis, and you count the times it says Vayomer, a sum total of, you guessed it, 9 times. So it says Vayomer Elokim Yihor, Vayomer Elokim Tatch Yaretz Deshe, all the different ma'amoros. Those are called utterances. Now, you notice that it's only 9 times if you actually do the count carefully, which is why the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph tells us that the 10th one is, the 10th Ma'amar is Bereshis, Bereshis itself. Bereshis was the first of the 10 utterances in order to be able to set up the station, the creation of the world. Well, what was created? You know, okay, I understand. Yehi Or, I understand the concept of light, of energy was created. I understand Yehi Rokia, that there's this notion of space which is created. But what in the world was Bereshis in the first time, in the first place? So the Sfarno suggests this, the Darius Eliyahu, the Vilna Gaon suggests that what was being created in Bereshis itself was a starting point, time. You need time for everything else to fall into it. Time and space, of course, but the first thing was time, necessary for all existence to fall into place. Which means the notion of time, secular time, so to speak, time as a container, was created at the beginning. What Rashi seems to be arguing and saying is, it's not that we need to cut out the stories. What Rashi's saying is that there's a different conception of time itself. And that is that time is not simply a space or a container. It's not a timeline. It is essentially a demarcated, specified destination process where I am moving towards a zman, to hazmana, or to a moed. I now have the control of moving towards a particular destiny where all these sum total of presence or present moments are adding up to a future moment. And that's a very different way of looking at time altogether. You know, if you look at it from the perspective of time being simply, so to speak, a container or the framework of existence, then unfortunately we can come to very, very negative or dislocated perspectives on reality. So there's a famous poem which some people attribute to the Peleoites, or the Ibn Ezra. There's lots of different attributions to this, but it's certainly in secular sources as well. And that is Ha'avar Ayin, the past, it doesn't exist. Ha'asid Adayin, the future, is still yet to be. Ha'avay Ka'arev Ayin, and the present is a split fraction, because every moment that it's happening is the present then moves on, and the present keeps shifting. And there's different endings of that poem. There's different ways to and we'll call it theological, philosophical results of that, whether one should worry, one should not worry as a result of that. But if you think about that, if you're just to sit there on the philosopher's stone for a moment and sit there wondering what is time, well, there's very little control we have over time, because everything that was, everything that will be, and the present is a very razor thin, even thinner moment, which keeps disappearing as it moves from past to future, if you think about that. And then the more you think about that, the more you'll arrive at concepts called carpe diem. So if ultimately I'm just in a long continuum, I'm in a long corridor of time, not of space at this point, but just in terms of time, then I'll say, you know what, carpe diem, seize the moment, or seize the day, to be more specific, because ultimately it's all going into oblivion and it's all come from oblivion. So therefore, because it's all meaningless, let me try to make meaning of the meaninglessness. What the Torah said is that no, the first thing you need to do is when you become free, the first thing you need to understand as you walk into freedom is that freedom isn't just freedom from freedom, it is freedom to. It's the ability to be able to choreograph and know your destination, where you're supposed to be going towards. What is ultimately the fact, the way that Rav Moshe Shapiro words it, is moving out of the concept of Shana. Shana is a repetition, right? The year, the annual, your cycle is just simply a continual repetition where it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. The seasons keep coming back until we create a global warming. But nonetheless, everything keeps going for an extended period of time, where there is really, in a certain sense, hergel, there's this concept of cycle. And the Torah says, no, 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 you're now going to be able to match chidush, renewal, the process of renewal and destination within those renewals, and you're going to be in control of that. And it's going to be now liquid. It's going to move. You're going to keep changing it depending on the changing of the mood. Things actually matter. Every moment matters. It's not that you have to seize the day because nothing matters. It's you're going to seize the day because everything matters. And that's ultimately the fact that we're all moving towards a destination, a long-term destination. If you think about that for a moment, that makes... Let's think about time now in this perspective. If my concept of time is simply as a container, as the framework of existence, then the more I think about it, the more ultimately I'm losing. The moment I'm born, I'm already dying. The moment I've lost is already gone and never retrievable, because ultimately the past is gone, the future's coming, the present is this razor-thin moment, and every moment I'm dying again. Every moment I'm losing something more. Because it just was. I can't control it. I can't grasp it. There's no way that it matters. It's fate. I'm living the life of the man of fate. And the Torah then says, no. HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem. I understand that time is moving towards something, that every moment is adding up towards a greater destination, and there are micro destinations along the way. We call those Mo'adim. And there's going to be a greater destination at the end of our lives, and there's going to be a greater destination at the end of all history. There is a moment towards which we are all moving. Thinking about things like that, if you think about that, isn't that the greatest metaphor itself for resurrection itself? Isn't that inbuilt into the system itself, the idea of resurrection of the dead? Dead not necessarily being just, we'll call it human corpses. Not necessarily the human faculties which are being resurrected, but time itself is being resurrected in the sense that time doesn't depend on dying and disappearing on a moment-by-moment basis. Time itself now is moving towards a long-term destination. And if it moves towards a long-term destination, then I can have the perspective and conception of there being every moment mattering in a way that I never would beforehand. Which is why Rashi says at the beginning of the Torah, just fascinatingly enough, that's what his question was. His question was, you know, Akash Baruch Hu, you talked about time as an existent, but as a power of existence of fate. You didn't tell us about destiny yet. You didn't tell us how we have the ability to choreograph, to set about, to know, to understand the viscosity, the flux of time, understand that there's destinations and we can make destinations. You didn't tell us that. So the Rashi says, surely it wouldn't be inappropriate to tell us at the beginning of the whole creation that ultimately time is also like what he hinted to in the day four, is that the Shemesh and Yoreach are also going to be, as was pretty explicit then, they're going to be signs, they're going to be mo'adim. See, already then it's hinted at, but it doesn't tell us how. The Torah doesn't tell us how to get there, into days and to years. So what is at the core of this is that the process of Exodus was not simply the fact that we now became free people. It became people moving towards a destination as opposed to people existing in the void of fate. That was what was really happening at this moment in time. And that process itself is the greatest metaphor itself for resurrection of the dead. Resurrection of the idea that the inborn into the system itself is that there's going to be a destination. And if there's a destination, we may not have seen the destination yet, but we know that ultimately it's moving towards that locale. It's interesting that just as a sidebar quickly, Rashi's answer to the question, Rashi asks the question, why is it that the Torah does not begin with HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem, Rosh Chodashim? It only starts with the conception of time of Bereshis, or the first moment of time, so to speak, just as this neutral space. Why is it that the Torah does that? So the answer Rashi gives there is because that it says, Koach Ma'asav Higidamo, quoting the Pasuk, that Hashem wanted to show His strength to His people by giving them Nachlas Goyim, the land of Israel. So when people say that we stole it, which they've done ultimately all throughout history, then we can have the perspective of knowing that it's really ours. And therefore, that was the reason why it's given. How does that relate to this whole conversation? So just an interesting side point, fascinating side point. What's the difference between the land of Israel and the rest of the lands of the world? Besides that, the greatest political hotbed in all history. So the Torah tells us in Parashas Akev that there's something unique about Israel. Here's how it goes. Ki arez asher ata bo shama, this land which you're going to, this is in Parashas Akev, Devarim Perik Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud to Yud Beis. The land which you're coming to, Like Eretz Mitzrayim, it's not like the same as the land of Egypt where you came from, right? Remembering Exodus from Egypt to Israel, right? The concept of moving out of the we'll call it primordial version of time into the more destiny version of time. There you just, you know, kick over with your leg and you open up the sluice gate, the farms will be irrigated and you'll all be happy. You're going to enter a land now. Now you're going to have to depend on rain. It's the land of valleys, of hills. You're going to have to depend on rain. It's not the same as the Nile opening out and overflowing once a year. It's the land where Hashem searches it out all the time. Hashem is there for the beginning to the end of the year. If you think about it, isn't that the same movement? Not in terms of time, but in place now. What's being said about Israel, what makes Israel distinct and unique, is the sense that when it came to Egypt, there was the regel. You know, so you use your foot, the regulus, the regular cycle of things. Every year, you know, the Nile's coming, you kick open that sluice gate. Now all the farms are going to be irrigated. All the canals are filled. Everything's fine. There's a, so to speak, there's an anticipated cycle. Everything's going to be as it is. It's always has been and always will be, still is today. When it comes to Israel, every moment in the present is dependent on the moment in the future. Isn't that interesting? Meaning like, even the weather patterns in the land of Israel are dependent on the fact that the present is dependent on the future. That I'm not thinking simply about now, but the now depends on the future. That's exactly the concept of time, what HaKadosh Elohim was supposed to be. That's why it says, in the process of Shana, of repetition, Hashem's there. Hashem's waiting for it. That's the concept, and that's perhaps what we needed to learn about the land of Israel, which is related to the idea, the concept of time. We needed to be able to appreciate that before we got the concept of time. Fascinating discussion in and of itself. Wanted to close with one last idea, and that is that we know that the resurrection of the dead will, as the Gemara in Ksuvos says on Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, Amud Aleph, that that ultimately, even though the resurrection of the dead will occur across the world, but ultimately the conduit, the portal of access will be Israel, which means to say that it's much easier to get to have the resurrection of the dead for the people who are buried in Eretz Israel. That's where it's going to be. That's, so to speak, the conduit. That's the place where it's all going to happen. Israel is the answer to the resurrection of the dead in terms of place. In time, it's how the idea that time has a destiny. But in terms of place, that's the land of Israel. And it is fascinating. It is really, really fascinating why this resonates with a number of aspects of what we've been doing over Pesach. You know that Mishnah we quoted in the Seder where it talks about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Ben Zoma? It says Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, "Ani harayni kibim shem shivim shana v'lo zichish shatama etshatama yitzis mitzrayim b'alela such drash ben Zoma." What the basic concept of that Mishnah is Lamantius Kroos Yom Tzeischa Meretz Mitzrayim Kol Yimei Chayecha. You need to remember the day of leaving Egypt all the days of your life. If you think about that concept itself, whether it means to say at nights as well or the times of Mashiach, that's the debate of Ben Zoma and the Chachamim. Irrespective of that debate, think about that for a moment. You're supposed to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim all the days of your life. Why? Well, the answer is not only is it because all the principles of faith are dependent upon it, but even the idea, the concept of Yomei Chayecha, the concept of time of your life, the days of your life are dependent on the Yetzias Mitzrayim principle itself. The first mitzvah necessary for us to leave Egypt was that time is moving towards something, that there is a destiny, that you are in control of that destiny. You're able to take the Shana and put into it Chodesh. If you're able to do that, that's something which now will inform all the days of your life, every moment of time that you exist within. And that's perhaps why the first time when Moshe Rabbeinu is appeared to by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the first nevuah he hears from Hashem is in the image of a snare, a burning bush. Isn't that fascinating? That's this notion of, so to speak, the death not being dead. The idea of something which should be being consumed, should be turning into ash, and the fire going out is not happening. There, the hasneh enenu ukal. The bush is not being destroyed. What does Hashem say His name is at that point in time when revealing to Himself to Moshe? Eheyeh asher eheyeh, I will be. Fascinating, isn't that interesting? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ultimate expression in the first time He talks to Moshe Rabbeinu, who's going to lead a nation, who are a slave nation in exile. What's the notion? Is I will be. Meaning to say, I understand there's a destiny to this whole process. There's a place we're going to in the future. If you understand that, then you can properly appreciate what the process as it unfolds. That's what we're moving towards, is destiny as opposed to fate. And that's perhaps why. That's the first revelation of Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Exodus experience. The last revelation of the Exodus expression, we'll call it strictly speaking Exodus, was of course at the Yam, the Kriyas Yam Suf, which is at the end of the 7 days after they leave. And after all that goes down, Moshe Rabbeinu leads Bnei Yisrael and says, "Az Yashir Moreshev Bnei Yisrael Asashir Azois." Then Moshe Rabbeinu sings the song and he leads Bnei Yisrael. And of course you notice that it's the wrong tense. It should be Az Shar. Then Moshe Rabbeinu sang. Sang is, that's the what, or Sharu, that's what that's when they sang. Yashir is the future, which is why the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in the same discussion about Tchias HaMesim, says, Mikan remez le Tchias HaMesim in HaTorah. Here you see a hint to Tchias HaMesim. Why? Why does Tchias HaMesim suddenly pop up at Az Yashir? What's the point of that? How does Tchias HaMesim fit into this whole rubric again? And the answer is for exactly that purpose. Is that God Baruch Hu is trying to inculcate into us that everything you've seen in the last 2,000 years of history, 2,000 plus, 3,300 years of history up to this point in time, is going to be reviewed now. You're going to now need 2,448 years of history needs to be reviewed at this point in time, as you understand that up till now we've been living in a world where there's a vacuum. Every day has just been a day. It's been the Shana. Now you're going to introduce into that Chiddush. Now you're going to introduce that Zman. Now you're going to introduce into that Moed. Now you're going to understand that just as time doesn't die because there's a destiny, so too human beings don't just die because there's a destiny. Now you're going to know that everything you're doing in your life adds up to a greater purpose. And ultimately, that is the Yesod of Tchias HaMesim. That is why it's also part of what we learn out of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is why it's so fundamental to our principles of faith. This closes the section, which I think is a very fascinating principle. He does have another essay on this exact same topic in a different way, but it's a little bit too much for one sitting. So, Mr. Shem, we will stop over here.